Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutalesi Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivishesha Sunyavari Pascharcha Deva Sacharani Om Gyanam Timurandasya Karanjana Shalakaya Chaksu Roon Meritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Trubhishta Kripa Sindhu Veba Chapatita Nampa Vanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. I have a little article here called Pornography for Women. This shock value day, we'll study women's pornography. But first, Chaitanya Charitamrita. I want to just to go a little bit, there's not much time, and I want to turn to the some of the more troubling practical applications that are bothering us in these modern or postmodern times. Silence the buzzsaws. you got it up as high as it'll go without feedback and everything like that, huh? Well, okay, we'll try that. Okay, how's that? You can also come forward away from the buzzsaws. I guess it's one good feature of ISKCON is that so many places we are living in construction sites. That's probably good, but it's certainly inconvenient sometimes. I wanted to go over a little bit about Lord Chaitanya in Benares, because I think it'll do a little good. But I'll give you the places where you can find these things. Lord Chaitanya with Prakasananda Saraswati, you'll find in the 7th chapter of Adi Lila, about from verses 106. Well, there's a lot more than that, but the key parts, 106 to 151. And also, more of it is given in Madhya Lila 25, around text 23 through 58. And then also, Lord Chaitanya's conversations with Sarva Bhauma Bhattacharya, with the same approach toward hermeneutics, is put forward. Because he says to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, after Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya talks for, 7 or 8 days, and Lord Chaitanya says, I can't understand a word you're saying. He said, the Vedanta Sutra is perfectly clear, but what you're saying I can't understand. And how can that be that it's clear? And then he explains it. It was clear. Anyway, that's Madhya Lila 6, 124 to 202. So those are places you can look, and you can see that from here, Lord Chaitanya lays down the principles, and he starts by saying that Vedanta philosophy, I'm at 106, Vedanta philosophy is the words consisting of the words of Narayan in the form of Vyasadeva, so that's the source, huh? And he says, therefore, the material defects of mistakes, illusions, cheating, and sensory inefficiency do not exist in the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These are the four defects of human-made knowledge, human-produced knowledge. Brahma, B-R-B-H-R-A-M-A, Brahma, Pramada, Vipralipsa, Karana, Apattava. If you want the Sanskrit, this is the verse you find it in Adi 7107 for the defects. So they're free from defects. And then Lord Chaitanya says, the absolute truth is described in the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutra, but must be one must understand the verses as they are. That is the supreme glory of understanding. Now the word that he uses here is tattva in truth and Mukhya vritya, direct understanding. Mukhya, means face. It's just what you see is what you get, as they say. And there's a distinction he makes between the direct understanding and the indirect gauna vritti, and there's mukhya, by direct understanding. And that's the way to understand these. So Prabhupada says, basically this mukya vritti, as is Prabhupada's, as it is, his direct understanding. And then he talks about Shankaracharya. The Shankaracharya used the described things in terms of this gauna vritti, indirect meanings. We don't have to get... Now, then he says, according to the direct understanding, now he's talking about here the Vedanta Sutra. He's been asked to explain Vedanta Sutra. So when Lord Chaitanya begins to explain, he says, according to the direct understanding, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth is the Supreme Personality of Godhead who has all spiritual opulences. I mean, this is the basic thing. When the Vedanta Sutra opens, it says we're going to talk about the Absolute Truth, and then Janmadasa Yataha, that from which everything comes. That's what the text says. It's defined as that by which the world is created, by whom it's maintained, and to whom it goes in the end. That's the definition of Brahman. But what Shankaracharya's commentary does, ultimately, is say that this is not true. Because the Shankaracharya comes out with the doctrine that the Absolute Truth has no energies. Therefore, the Absolute Truth actually is not that which... from which everything comes, by which everything is maintained, and to which everything goes. Because basically there is no everything. So the direct face, straightforward meaning announced right at the very beginning what the Absolute Truth is in effect denied by Shankaracharya. We don't have time to get into the whole method of commenting on the Vedanta Sutra. So then Lord Chaitanya says... he describes the Absolute Truth, what it means. He has potencies and energies. His body is not material, the living entity. So he then gives a little summary of everything we've ever been taught. Then he gets down to the particulars. He actually is very directly isolated where Shankaracharya does the job, where he turns the Vedanta Sutra around. It's the Brahma Sutra, the Vedanta Sutra, second chapter, first aphorism. That's where, in his commentary, he denies the energies of the Lord. So Prabhupada says, by the way, we intend to present the Vedanta Sutra in another volume, but it's something he never did. So that's our project. Remember, the BI is supposed to do that. So let me go on to where we talk about the... So then Lord Chaitanya presents a reading of the Vedanta Sutra according to the criterion he sets forward, that what he calls the direct meaning. Oh, nuts. I'm sorry, I'm trying to use this folio system here of bookmarks. Okay, go down to where... I wish I could just... Can't you just page down to them and without having to go through this... And then he says how they do a switch on things, that the Mahavakya, the major statement, is the Omkara, but Shankaracharya substitutes for this the mantra Tattvamasi. That's another thing that they do. And then he says, in all the Vedic sutras and literatures, it is Lord Krishna is to be understood. But the followers of Shankaracharya have covered the real meaning of the Vedas with indirect explanations. And then he says, the self-evident Vedic literature, this swata pramana, swata, its own, pramana means evidence, and it's self, swata is self, self-evident. is the highest evidence of all, but if these literatures are interpreted, that is this Gona Vritti or Lakshana Vritti, they're not taken as they are, then the self-evident nature is lost. So it can happen that something can be self-evident, but it's been covered by misinterpretation. To prove their philosophy, the members of the Mayavada school have given up the real, easily understood meaning of the Vedic literature and introduced indirect meanings based on their imaginative powers. Now, doesn't this sound like Prabhupada talking about the Bhagavad Gita? It's clear, it's self-evident, it's easy to understand, but people have... This is where Prabhupada gets this from. It's from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Prabhupada says, unfortunately, the Shankarite interpretation has covered almost the entire world. Therefore, there is a great need to present the original, easily understood, natural import of the Vedic literatures. This word comes up too, natural, sahaja, the natural import of the Vedic literatures. Therefore, we have begun by presenting Bhagavad Gita as it is. And we propose to present all the Vedic literature in terms of the direct meaning of the words. So here Prabhupada explicitly says he's doing exactly in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that's why I'm a little afraid of trying to, you know, not follow Prabhupada's method, because I'm not only going against Srila Prabhupada and a lot of other people, but also Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I mean, this is what I'm saying. Once you start to pull a little thread, you know, the whole sweater unravels. So in this way, then the Mayavadis say, okay, that's your principles, and now tell us how you can explain them in terms of this direct understanding. And so then he uses this method, which is just summarized as this sambandha, abhideya, and prayojana, the knowledge of the relationships, the absolute truth, the jivas in the world, the means of progress, and the description of the final end. So when he finished explaining this, the Mayavadis, it just says their minds changed. So I think that from looking at this, that their experience was that what he showed was self-evidence. In other words, he just revealed to them Vedanta Sutra. They'd been studying it all their lives, but suddenly, it was self-evident. Now there are several features, I think, of self-evidence. What Chaitanya Mahaprabhu does is he takes this idea, the absolute truth is a person with energies. That's the leading idea. As he says to Stahl, you have to understand what the unifying principle is. And then on the basis of the unifying principle, you adjust all apparently disparate statements. Because the Vedanta Sutra deals with the statements in the Upanishads. Some of them talk about impersonal realization, and some talk about personal realization. Because the Upanishads have the records of the realizations of sages, and some of them had personal and some of impersonal. Now, these are both valid spiritual experiences. And some, I guess, a super soul realization, too. So all of these are there. So it sounds like, well, some describe the absolute truth this way, some that way. How do we reconcile them? Now, the reconciliation is given in the aphorisms of the Vedanta Sutra. Now, if you take the impersonal as the highest aim and you try to adjust everything, it becomes very messy. Things get very convoluted. There are texts in the Vedanta Sutra which describe the absolute truth, which becomes the opposing party statement to be refuted. Lord Chaitanya, by taking the personal as the highest, then everything falls into place. You see, everything becomes fits. It becomes coherent. So the coherence, the holding together, the logical coherence of the Vedanta Sutra increases. You don't have to explain away so many things. And then when you see, that's one feature, I think, of the self-evidence. It's almost not like a proof. You just see it. Yeah, this is the way it hangs together. It's naturally, it's not strained. You don't have to take odd meanings of words. You can take the natural meaning. And so in this way, you get a coherent presentation. I think that's part of it, of this self-evidence. And they just saw it. Yeah, this has to be... But now the Vedanta Sutra, it makes much more sense. It's clear, it's coherent, it's simple. Simplicity also becomes a principle of self-evidence. It's not convoluted. You know, you're not trying to scratch your ear like this, but you just, you know, it's that kind of thing. And I want to just say one thing that in the sacred books of the East, which was published by Max Müller. There are several Vedanta Sutra commentaries, and the translator was a guy by the name of...
I'm not really sure how you pronounce his name.
He translated the Shankaracharya Bhasha, the Sharirika Bhasha, and also the Sri Bhasha of Ramanuja. Both of those are in the Sacred Books of the East series. This was done a long time ago, in the 30s or something. In this, the second edition of the Sri Bhasha, he defends himself because he made the remark that actually, if you understand the Vedanta Sutra according to Ramanuja's way of understanding, which is similar to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's, of course, that it actually seems to actually fit the natural order of the Vedanta Sutra. And he gives many, many different examples, and therefore he thinks that actually the commentary that comes closest to the actual intent of the Vedanta Sutra is Ramanuja, and Shankaracharya is highly artificial and convoluted. So Thibaut says that he got so much mail after he said that in the first edition. So he was defending himself. And he said, but most of the objections I got from Indian intellectuals, most of the objections I got were merely trying to make a philosophical case for the position of Shankaracharya. He said, about that I have nothing to say. All I'm talking about is the critical case about what is the meaning of Vedanta Sutra. And as far as I can see, the meaning of Vedanta Sutra is that it's theistic, like Ramanuja says. And then he goes on and shows how, if you just look at the text, this is what they're saying. So he said, he's not talking about a philosophical issue, but what he calls a critical issue. That is, what is the meaning of the verses? So that's his, Thibault's thing is very widely available. It's still in print from India. So if you want to look at it sometime and get into Vedanta Sutra, there you see somebody who backs up our understanding. And I guess Thibault is somebody who comes to it sort of philosophically neutral. And he remarked how surprised he was to discover this, because he had just had always understood that the commentator on the Vedanta is Shankaracharya, and he was really surprised to find out that he had been misled. So that's a neutral position. So those episodes are very worth studying. I just want you to show, anyway, go over it enough with episodes with Chaitanya to show where it is that Prabhupada gets his ideas from. We say this all the time, but it's good to see it. I think we'll now spend a little time on the this topic about we've seen that Prabhupada tells us that we should take things. We cannot pick and choose. We cannot follow the example of accepting half the hin. We have to take the whole thing. That if the Vedic authority is there, we cannot make ourselves an authority by saying, I like this part, I don't like that part. So then we come to the parts that we don't like, that don't fit our modern sensibility, or that conflict with our sense perception. So I think if we take Prabhupada seriously, what we have to do when we see things that are that seem wrong, either morally wrong or factually wrong, is that we have to say, well, okay, our principle is the Vedic information should be accepted as true. But clearly we need to do something to understand how it is true. First, do I really understand it accurately? Do I really understand what is being said? That's one investigation I have to make. Because if it looks apparently false, maybe I don't really understand the whole matter. Usually this is an investigation of context. And the other thing is to say if then I think I understand it accurately, is my sense perception or the inference based on sense perception, it must be somehow partial, deluded, misdirected, or irrelevant to this case. And then I have to do a critical investigation of my mundane knowledge. In this case, I think we could do very well about taking some of the things as a guide for our empiric investigation. And you might find great additions to our knowledge. So we see that Prabhupada many times makes this point about the nature of women, the position of women, ultimately that somehow they should be dependent upon a man. He's very much against woman's liberation. There's a heavy commentary about that in the Bhagavad Gita, where the demons don't know what is to be done and not to be done. Prabhupada's big example is the woman's liberation movement. So he wants to say, that women are dependent. I was there. I was present when Prabhupada discussed this with a reporter. There was a couple of reporters, both of them women. One he liked very much, and the other he didn't like at all, in Philadelphia. So this issue became raised, and this was just after Chicago, when we made this controversial statement about 34 ounces or whatever it was, and so it was in the newspapers. So this was a hot topic. And Prabhupada first said, "I don't want to discuss it, but okay, I will." And so then he wanted to say first he said, actually he said this woman's liberation is really a trick on women by men, so that basically men get access to sexual partners without having to take any responsibility. I said, that's what's really going. It's because your position is, as a woman, that you are naturally in a dependent position. He says, suppose you have sex with some man, you get pregnant. But because you're independent, then the man has no obligation to take care of you or your baby. So what are you going to do? So because you're independent, now you have to beg from the government. In other words, go for social welfare. I'm an unmarried mother, a pregnant woman, so now please give me money. So now you're dependent upon the government. Is that an improvement, he said. Or your other thing is you can kill your own child. Is that a good choice? Is that a good choice? And this reporter said, well, she chooses, you know, at least it's her choice. And Prabhupada said, that is 34 ounces. It was so fast, you know, that she... the position he was making it has to do with biology and with the nature of the material body. Why is that important? Well, because as it turns out that Varnashram Dharma is important for Srila Prabhupada. And this is more or less a modern revival in our tradition. Because following Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, most of our tradition didn't pay any attention to Varnashram Dharma because you take to the path of devotional service and, as Lord Chaitanya said to Ramananda Roy, that is superficial. You have to go much beyond that, and we're not concerned with Varnashram Dharma. You know, I said that is superficial or something like that. Where's that effect? Huh? External. Yeah, that is external. That is external. And when Prabhupada started talking about Varnashram Dharma and said this, this was brought up to Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, we are not so advanced. We are not so advanced. But actually, the emphasis on Varnashram Dharma seems to have been reintroduced by Bhaktivinoda Thakur when he envisioned propagation of Krishna consciousness, and that there needed to be a context in which people who weren't on the spontaneous platform could perform Vaidhi Bhakti under the best circumstances. This is in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita, and that's Varnashram Dharma, but not the hereditary caste system, which was a corruption, but what he called the scientific Varnashram Dharma, or the Daivi Varnashram Dharma, that which is given by Krishna, which is scientific, which is based on the modes of material nature, on natural propensities rather than hereditary. So there's a whole mundane social system that you want to bring into view, into practice. And I think over the course of time, this project has been carried through by Bhaktisiddhanta, and now especially Srila Prabhupada has been talking about this revival or restoration of Varnashram Dharma. Otherwise, we're transcendental. And if you speak on the Vaishnava platform, then there's no distinction between men and women. That's why Prabhupada was perfectly happy to say, as we saw in that letter, I think in this movement the women are more intelligent than the men. Or that same evening, you know, after he did that put down to that reporter, he told Vishakha, no, when a woman joins the movement, her brain grows. I mean, at that point, if you become a devotee and we commit ourselves to the principles of spiritual advancement and we do that capably, then you won't see any difference. Or maybe the women may be better. But before that, there's a difference that has to be observed. And I think we can understand why Prabhupada was into this if we see this entire context. First of all, the whole picture of the universe given in the Vedas depends on a couple of things that go sort of hand in hand with feminism. And one is the emphasis on hierarchy. According to feminist thinkers, hierarchy is a male invention. Well, if that male was Krishna, I guess so. But it's according to Prabhupada, it's quite natural. He said in one letter to a devotee, it is a fact of nature that the strong control the weak and utilize the energy of the weak. This sounds like the thing that super right-wing kind of people like to emphasize, the strong control the weak. And then they want to say, and I'm strong and you're weak. The strong control the weak. See, because people don't like this inequality, the strong and the weak, and then we try to do things sometimes by social engineering, is trying to deny that there's such a difference or somehow handicap the strong or give some help to the weak that they don't normally have, and try to level the playing field of life so everything is more fair. But Prabhupada is not, he's saying this is a law of nature, that it's a law of nature. And the project, I think, of trying to reorganize material nature, if that's our job, is going to be really a tough one. So the Vedic system is to understand nature better. And this is how Prabhupada does it. He says, the strong control the weak and utilize the energy of the weak. He said, but who is actually strong? Then that becomes the critical question. You see in the material world, you see these big deals, again, all the generals, the commanders, the strong people, and they control others, and they think, yeah, I'm strong and I'm powerful. But they turn out to be weak before material nature. Durga Devi is stronger. All of them have to be ultimately controlled and crushed by her. He points out that she's very strong because she has 10 arms, each with a weapon. And she rides a lion or a tiger. And if you look at the depiction under the forepaw of the tiger, there's a little guy down there being crushed. That's the materialist, according to Prabhupada. And the trident is jabbing him. That's the strong guy down there being crushed under the paw. And the trident, just one of the weapons of Durga, the trident means the threefold miseries. So therefore, before material nature, everyone is weak. And yet, she is afraid to appear in front of Krishna. Before Krishna, she's very meek and very weak. So Krishna is actually strong. So now you get to the point that Prabhupada is making, that if the understanding is theirs, who is actually strong, and we voluntarily, as the weak people, agree to be controlled by the strong, means we agree to Krishna's control, then everything falls into place. And this hierarchical of order things actually will work nicely. The reason it's become disturbed is those people who falsely take the position of God. We see that happen, and then we say, well, let's get rid of hierarchy. It's no good. It's elitist. And we try to get rid of it. But it always reasserts itself. Every time you try to level the playing field by social engineering, somehow or other it comes back. The Prabhupada told Professor Kotovsky, he said, Varna system we have four. He said, but in Russia, you have the party bosses and you have the ordinary citizens. So you have two. So what's the difference in principle between two and four? Somebody has to be in control, he said. So it always brings itself up. The other thing that goes together with this is this notion of essentialism, that women have a nature, men have a nature, Brahmins have a nature, Kshatriyas have a nature, you know, Swabhava, Swadharma. These things are also part and parcel of this rejection of the traditional way of thinking. But it's clear from the Vedic presentation that we do have natures. And where do they come from? They're not a construct by people in power to keep themselves in power. They're given by Krishna. They're created by Brahma, who sees the Vedas and then puts them into creates material world accordingly. So there are essences, according to our philosophy. And the idea is, and the Vedic system is really based on this. Let us see what people's natures are and engage them according to that nature so they can make their greatest contribution. That way, people will be satisfied. And so the descriptions are there, are these natures, say, of the four varnas. And those, in turn, are based on the three modes of material nature. And so these things are all quite empirical and can be researched. I think a great deal of social and psychological research should be based on the idea of the three modes of material nature. So Prabhupada wanted to start this, wanted Varnashram Dharma. And one of the major two things he had done. One is he wanted ISKCON to create Brahmins. As he said over and over again, we are trying to create Brahmins. We're trying to do the alchemical thing and turn bell metal or copper into gold. We were trying to create Brahmins. And the second thing was he wanted some self-sufficient societies based on cow protection, the land and the cows. That was the other two parts. And I was thinking of why these two things. And I got a little help from an anthropologist, a guy named Harris. And it was clear to like if you look at the system of Varna, you'll find that one way to determine, one way what's very important to what varna you belong to is your vritti, your how you maintain yourself, your means of livelihood. So, for example, Brahmana's vritti is they live on charity. This is very important. Brahmins don't accept a paycheck. As soon as you accept the paycheck, by the way, you're a shudra. And then the nature of modern society is to turn us all into shudras. But Brahmanas, they live on charity. Prabhupada said a Brahmana would go into a town, a village, sit down, and teach anyone. Anyone who came in would not ask for money. No tuition. He said this way India meant free education for everybody. Naturally, the parents would say, oh, this nice Brahmana, he's teaching our children. Here's some cloth, here's some rice. So he had everything he needed, no problem. And if he had excess, the other part of his vritti is to give in charity. He would give, he would not save for the future. So if a devotee thinks they're Brahmin, that's the way to live. You live in charity, and if you have anything excess, you give. You live on charity, you have any excess, you give in charity. What about your old age pension? If you're really worried about that, maybe you're not a Brahmana. Anyway, the Kshatriyas, by taxation and fines and things like that, booty actually, war profits, and Vaishyas by agriculture and cow protection and trade. And those who are not capable of being economically independent, in their various ways, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas are all economically independent. They don't work for anybody else. They have autonomy as far as their own living goes. But if somebody can't function that way, then they become an assistant to some one of the others. That's what's called a shudra. Prabhupada's name is general assistant. If you don't know whether a person is a Vaishya or a shudra, give them $10,000 and see what happens. If they bring back 20, they're Vaishyas. If they come back for more money, anyway, this is the system is based on vritti. So what is the vritti of the whole system? The vritti of the whole system is land and cows. The mode of production is not industrial production, but it's agrarian society. And the thing about cow protection is if you think it through, it forces you to be agrarian. Because The farms are now, we are looking at industrialized farming, and one tractor replaces 10 farm workers. Prabhupada hated tractors. As soon as you go down to, well, this is our problem in ISKCON. We have trained oxen. We don't have the people to work them, because you need a large farm population. The industrial economy, people have moved off the farms, often by force. They were forced, literally in England, they were forced off of the farms and herded into the factories. Or by economic arrangement, they can no longer live on the farm. And the farms get bought up by bigger and bigger absentee landlords who now run them by machines. This is the industrialization of agriculture. So the fact is, it is only under the conditions of an industrial society that you have the modern mixture and merging and confusing of genders. And men and women are more or less become increasingly indistinguishable from each other in their behavior. And people are trying to figure out how can men have babies, and they really are. And of course, the idea of modern control over reproduction, part of it is to give the woman basically the same attitude toward sex as men. You can just do it and walk away and no consequences, which is not a really great thing for the men either, but now that women can have this advantage, because pregnancy is no longer... There's another thing in industrial society, the disassociation of sex from reproduction. They don't have anything to do with each other. You have sex for fun and reproduction. You know, you go to some lab and take advantage of modern reproductive technologies and whatever, surrogate mothers, surrogate wombs. You know, and it all becomes the separation sex and reproduction is also an artifact of an industrial economy. But if we look at an agrarian society, then you'll see, because the thing about an industrial economy you should notice is that children become a very expensive hobby. I know this very expensive hobby was first told to me by a devotee who said cow protection is a very expensive hobby. And I started to think about it. And I realized, why is it? Prabhupada said it's the most valuable thing. Cows are valuable. It's clear that certainly in an industrial society, cow protection is a very expensive hobby. And one reason is you can't make any economic use of the bulls. And Prabhupada is quite clear that if bulls are not economically useful, then the system will never work. Because there's a point that there is a deep connection between your means of livelihood, your how you make your money, and your values and your ethics and your social arrangements. I mean, this is something noticed by Marx. And so many times Marx says your means of production determines your values. But you can go the other way around. What are our values? And now let's find the means of production that support them. So that's why an agrarian society supports the values of being transcendentalists. So we need an agrarian society. It's based on cow protection. In an industrial society, the cow protection is not economically viable. You need to use the bulls for plowing. So then I noticed that it also children are a very expensive hobby. If you in an industrial economy, say in the United States, the estimation is that what it costs to raise a child to the age of 18, we're not talking about going to advanced studies, is people give about $250,000, $300,000. That's what it costs. And then what's your return on your investment? Well, once a year on your birthday, you get a postcard, you know. But in an agrarian society, children are an asset. Because the family is the unit of production. And what you have to say in an industrial society where people say to each other, can we afford to have a child? And really more and more the trend. Old to have a child, and then taking advantage of modern reproductive technologies, you know, they have a child at the age of 45 or 50 years old, as long as so they can make enough money, and then maybe you can have your one hobby child at the end, and because people can't afford them, both the husband, the nature of industrial society. It requires that the husband and wife both be in the labor force, which has a great deal to do with woman's liberation, is actually the fact that it's required. What happened is, as the industrial economy began to expand in the 1950s and 60s, they suddenly discovered we got this whole pool of cheap labor sitting right around us that's called women. And that's how it began to happen. For a brief period of time, one person could support a family, but no more. So now both have to work as the rule. So that both parents are working. The woman can't afford to have a baby. It's a big choice. Shall I have a career or shall I take care of this baby? Well, you try to do both. And so really, you work and you make just enough money to pay for the child care. Which is usually in the hands of somebody, you know, from a third world country or something who's acting to take care of your children. So they're being taken care of with somebody else. And really the major caretaker of the children is, as we have heard in another class, is the television set. That's with whom they have the most association. This is what's happening in this way. So you people say, can we afford to have a child? So, one or two at the most. Huh? In an agrarian society, it's a disaster if you don't have a child. In fact, you need a lot of them. The more, the better. So the characteristic of an agrarian society is lots and lots of children. Because they're an asset. And because the family is the unit of production, if you have a little family farm, at 5 years old, the children start to participate in the family economic activities. They continue to do so. They take over as they grow older. And then they're the social welfare of the parents when they're old. They take care of the parents when they're old. So you need children. People like big families. Then it's a necessity. And what you see now in the industrial economies, like these European countries and Japan and America, the people who are living there are not reproducing fast enough to replace themselves. It's actually, they're dying out. It's racial suicide or whatever you want to call it. The ultimate result is people are not having children. And in order to keep a labor force, they have to bring in a third world migrant workers, the guest Gastarbeiter, you know, whatever. In America, we have Mexicans, and here you have people from Turkey and, wherever it may be. They have to bring them in. And they have to. They can't, there's nobody, otherwise there's nobody to do the work for the future. So let's go back to this idea of an agrarian society. And then once you have an agrarian society, children become valuable again in a way they're not valuable now. I mean, we love our children, but they're it's a hobby. You love them more if they also are economically... they're part of the group, you know, the enterprise. So just imagine now. So now we need to have lots of children, 5, 6, something like that. What becomes of the role of a woman? Automatically now, childbearing becomes a major activity of a woman. But that's not a bad thing because actually children are very valuable, so the activity of a woman, a mother, turns out to be a very, very valuable activity. Right now, you know, that people don't really see that this is making such a social contribution to take care of children, forgetting that, you know, children are the future. And so in this way, if you see the whole project, and you go back to an agrarian society, which is Krishna's natural arrangement, it will naturally happen that men and women will again have sexually differentiated roles. It's still that way. I happened to pick up somebody's book on mental health in the family, and they describe people's mental disturbances as being either related to their relationship with the mother or the father. They didn't want to say the mother and the father because those are essentialist sexist terms. So they said the protective figure, that is the father, is now, it could be a woman, but the protective, one has to be the specialist as the protective figure, and the other as the nurturing figure. So there was the protective figure and nurturing figure, understanding that, you know, the nurturing figure could be male and the protecting figure female, or vice versa, or both could be male, or both could be female, which pretty much exhausts the combinations, at least up to so far. But I think the Vedic system is, why not have the men be the men and have the women be the women? This is mukhya vritti. You know, this is the direct meaning. Instead of, you know, because you can do it. You can take a woman and turn her into a man. I've seen it happen before my very eyes practically, especially with chemicals, testosterone, and, you know, you can do it. Or you by culture and training, you can turn women into men, and you can turn men into women. Why bother? Why do all that? You know? So Prabhupada's idea was that the Vedic idea is that if men specialize in being men and develop those masculine, you know, protective powers and virtues, and the women the nurturing, then say a child will get the full force of both of these at their height, because it's very difficult to combine both of these in the same person. They're kind of emotionally and psychologically, they're a little incompatible. So best one do one and one do the other. So the best person to do the protective is the men, and the best person to do the nurturing is the women. And if the women can be specialists in it, then the children gets the real advantage. If Prabhupada said the Bengali mother, you know. The way mothers used to be. I would suggest this idea of being protective is also very helpful for developing nurturing figures, because I think if a woman acts in the world the way a man does, she has to get tough. And we all know women can get tough. They can be as tough as any man, tougher sometimes. It can be done. There's no problem. But they I think to the extent that you become tough, you may well lose the ability to be a nurturing figure. So in this way, if there's protection from some of the, you know, rougher aspects of the world and everything that men are supposed to do for women and actually protect them, then I think femininity could develop all its full qualities and characteristics. I don't think we haven't seen a lot of things. I don't think we've seen real Brahmins. I don't think we've seen real Kshatriyas. Prabhupada said that. There are probably some real Vaishyas, but we don't know who they are. If they're real smart, they'll stay below the radar. We've seen a lot of Shudras. I don't think we've seen much of real men. We haven't seen much of real women. All this remains in the future by the system. So this is what I think Prabhupada's point is. Why he's making this thing about the position of women. As far as the intelligence business goes, I said that if a woman takes to self-realization, then there's no question that they're as intelligent as men, because what Prabhupada really says that when he talks about intelligence in this case, is not the ability to perform on IQ tests, be math geniuses, or any of those things, but rather its ability to take to the renunciation of sense gratification and material life. This comes more naturally, I would think, to men than to women, especially if women are in their traditional roles. Then you're much more entangled in family affection, and you need to be. So it becomes a little difficult, this idea of, you know, I'm, you know, the big goodbye, as Maharaj is telling us about the Grosa Abschied, huh? I'm leaving the village, I'm going to the hills, you know. Because it used to be in the traditional Vedic society that transcendence meant leaving the village, going off by yourself into the forest. And it's very difficult, much more difficult for women. It's hard enough for men, much more difficult for women to do that. The difference is with Krishna consciousness is that what you see in the Bhagavad Gita is what I have called in academic circles the domestication of transcendence, or the project of transcendence. It becomes something you can do at home. You don't have to leave your town, leave your village, leave your position in Varnashram Dharma, because this is Bhakti Yoga. And that's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, listing those previously people who thought were not qualified, women are mentioned, now they become qualified because of Bhakti Yoga. So that's what Prabhupada means by this. Transcendence seems more naturally a male project. And that's why in many sections of the Bhagavatam, it's described as a male project, and that the thing which holds you back is a woman. And there's the tendency of the identification of who represents material nature. Well, it's a woman. That's because it's the male who has to transcend, and that means giving up attachment to women. When Prabhupada wants to translate this into our context of devotional service, he said in one lecture, when it was talking about men and women, and he must have looked at it, the audience, and seen all his female disciples, he explained, he says that for the man, woman is the woman, but for the woman, man is the woman. Meaning, women means here the member of the opposite sex to whom you are attached. So he made that adjustment. One has to understand these texts, but in that way. But it means that I think that is more instinctively or naturally a male project to transcend, to get out, to adventure, to go to the moon. Cross the oceans in ships, you know, to seek out adventure. I think that's on the lower level, that's the same urge, which on the higher level becomes the urge for transcendence, and it's something that seems to come more naturally to men. So anyway, I think something like that, we understand why Prabhupada emphasized this as I said, there was no question in anybody's mind that Prabhupada was a sexist. It's unfortunately that the statements that Prabhupada made have been used in this way for lording it over material nature and exploitation of women. Men are supposed to protect women, but of course they wonder who's going to protect us from our protectors. And so you can certainly understand the women's liberation movement and the feminist movement and so on by people's experience, just like you can understand communism by looking at the plight of the workers all over the world. You know, every time you visit some sweatshop somewhere, you want to be a communist. It's natural. But that doesn't mean that's the way to remedy the situation. Our way to remedy the situation is actually have the men be women, the men be men, and the women be women. Have the king be king, and the Brahmin, and do what you're supposed to do. I want to bring up one other thing. I promised about talking about pornography for women. This comes up because the charge has been made that Prabhupada made the claim that women like to be raped. This is part of the case that was made that Prabhupada is a sexist and a male elitist. Apparently, men who like raping often like to claim that women like to be raped. And Prabhupada is quoted as having saying this. But actually what Prabhupada said is a little different. Well, this also came up because Hari Kesh started making this charge against Prabhupada. Well, that's when it came up fairly recently. The statement that Prabhupada made in this regard, you can find in Srimad Bhagavatam, where he's talking about actually the nature of sexual desire. This is in Bhagavatam 4:25-41, the purport. The woman says, "Oh, my dear hero, who in this world will not accept a husband like you? You are so famous, so magnanimous, so beautiful, and so easily gotten." So Prabhupada says, every woman is certainly a great hero to his wife. And in other words, the woman loves a man, that man appears very beautiful and magnanimous, and so on. Then Prabhupada goes into something that sounds weird. The husband is considered magnanimous because he gives many children to the wife as she likes. Who wants children, right? He talks about how one should satisfy a wife, and then in this regard, the word "vikyatam" is significant. "Vikyatam" means famous, as Prabhupada translates it as famous. A man is always famous for his aggression toward a beautiful woman. And such aggression is sometimes considered rape. Although rape is not legally allowed, it is a fact that a woman likes a man who's very expert at rape. Now, notice, he doesn't say a woman likes a man who rapes. The key word here is expert. This is the key word. Because as it turns out, there's a good deal of literature to document that this is true. And I happen to remember when I read this and I heard this charge that Prabhupada said women like being raped, and this was cited. I mean, this is what he says, expert. Doesn't mean being knocked over in a parking lot by some stranger. So this is old. I mean, this is 1975 article in the New York Times. But there's actually considerable, and I just happened to go back and get this because I remembered reading it a long time ago. An American writer, a woman, Lois Gould, Pornography for Women, that apparently what turns men on doesn't turn women on at all. But there's certain things that women really like that are sexually arousing. That's what men buy pornography, literature or works of art that are supposedly cause sexual, their tendencies to cause sexual arousal. What women like, men don't like. And so, and as it turns out, to make a long story short, there's been a lot of research, and this is something that I could investigate this further, but it's not really what I want to read about. Men get turned on apparently by pretty exclusively by very, you know, the sort of anatomical plumbing in action, you know, really gross depictions of sex, which women don't seem to like very much, at least. But what they like better is sort of romance with a heavy emotional content, and not graphic at all. But the ones that really seem to really like she describes two different scenes from literature and turned into films. One is the famous American novel Gone with the Wind, which was a book and then became a big movie with Clark Gable as Rhett Butler and Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara. And he's a real guy, you know, Rhett Butler, raffish connections with the underworld and gambling. And Scarlett O'Hara is a very willful woman who is in a position of some independence, actually, because she's inherited this mansion. This takes place in the American South just after the Civil War, or during the Civil War. She has this whole plantation and everything that she's inherited, and she's very good, she's very independent, very strong-willed. And she falls in love with Rhett Butler, and he marries her. But she's a decent woman, you know. I mean, so he's thinks it's improper really to let it all go in sexual relations with her, you know. Because she's on the pedestal, so to speak. But finally, they have these big fights and these big conflicts, and the main scene is really finally he picks her up in his arms, you know, and there's this big spiral staircase, and he carries up the staircase, and she's banging on his chest, "Let me down, let me down, let me down," you know. And disappears in the bedroom, and it fades, you know. But it's basically a rape, but expert. And this one is one of the things that women universally report, widely report as being one of the best things they ever saw as far as sexual arousal goes. Another one, anyway, there's several scenes like this in books and movies. So there is a lot of documentary evidence that, and apparently it's of some concern to feminists that women are having sexual fantasies which are not correct, that they should not be having, and they're hoping that in the course of time, you know, they'll learn to change. But anyway, that's why Prabhupada said what he said. He was not sanctioning rape. I just wanted to get that out in the open for this one, and again he's talking what is sort of naturally there in a woman, naturally there in a man, we should take it at that. We do have our natures. Okay, let's have some discussion on this matter. Yes. The mobile microphone is available. No, we don't know where the mobile mic is. Somebody put it in their pocket and walked out in the last class, huh? Still, we have it now. It doesn't work. Want to shake it? Well, I'll have to check that out. That's all I can say. I don't know. I'm sure there are many, many findings of all kinds of things, especially from Harvard. Anything else? Huh? Yeah?
about a book you have written. Can you comment on the difference between accepting things as they are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if you accept the word and not this purpose behind it, what is the use? That's also corresponds to the idea of following the regular principles just for the sake of following them. So, just accepting the literal meaning of texts, not applying them to your lives, not understanding what the purpose is. And if you don't understand what the purpose is, then you don't know how to apply, even taking the literal meaning. What applies here? What applies there? Everything has to be applied. One thing you should understand about all these things, about the literal meaning, what you see with Prabhupada all the time, and which confuses people a lot, is how sensitive he is to context. And will say very different things in different contexts. But all saying, you know, I don't change anything. And according to A.K. Ramanujan, who was a professor at the University of Chicago, he claims that, he says Indian thinking, but it comes from the Vedas, differs from Western thinking, because he says that Indian thinking is context specific. You take it and you relate it very carefully to the particular context. You look at the person. And one major criterion for understanding what the application is, what is good for this person's spiritual advancement? What applies for this person's spiritual advancement? And a lot of times, that's why Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita sometimes not to disturb people. And what will be good for one person will be bad for another. That's why I could collect this whole thing about is household or life good or bad? You know, I can get a yes column and a no column. Because if you're a person who's unregulated, a rogue, doesn't follow any principles, household or life is great. You want to have sex without responsibility, household or life is wonderful. But if you become attached to household or life and you're not making any more advancement because of it, then it's a dark well. It should be given up. It's, you know. So it depends on the context. But he says Western thinking, I forget his exact word, but it means it's context invariant. You want to have one thing that applies across the board in all situations. So what gives us the ability to apply things correctly in context is understanding the spirit as well as the letter. Both of these things have to be together. And that's one of the major important aspects of what is the spirit of the thing.
It is not easily ascertained. For example,
yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's the next course, you know. How many Prabhupadas are there? and which is the true Prabhupada? You should invite Jayadvaita Swami there. Yet another Prabhupada. Anyone else? Yes? Mm-hmm. Well, it could mean, I don't know the context that Prabhupada said this in. There's a way, there is actually a way to be a man in a family and still be renounced. That's one thing. If by renounce he means take sannyas, no, one should not be irresponsible. The idea that if all the men are renounced, then the women will be left by themselves and there won't be any husbands, I wouldn't worry about it. You can encourage men to be renounced as much as you like, but most of us, it's a gradual process. I don't think this was ever the intention. There was an idea at one point early in the movement that maybe spread by some leading sannyasis that most men were going to be renounced and be brahmacharis. This turned out to be a false perception. So now it's as they say, a moot point. It's not really a practical issue at all, I don't think, anymore. Yes? Yeah, they can, don't they? I see them, you know, sitting around the Bonhofs of Europe with more of their freedom. Yes. I don't see that in these extended families people had that attitude toward their children. They loved their children very, very much. But that love was supported by the economics. And that's what I think has to be there. You find your values and then you find the economics that supports them. So just because something is economic, and certainly it can only increase love if somebody's economically valuable. I mean, how come many women find men who have money more lovable than men who don't? Because it's one of the attractive, one of the opulences. Money, it increases lovability. So anything that increases a person's value is good, whether it's economic value. And you have to remember, this is the material world. Hardly anyone gets loved just because they're spirit souls. They usually have to make something, contribution to somebody else's material welfare. So I think it's generally a positive thing. Maharaj? Less, they have smaller families. They tend to have smaller families. That's one thing. The value for a Brahmin is less economic than it is having somebody to whom you can pass on your knowledge and make sure that Vedic culture gets transmitted. The other thing is that especially for Brahmins, but it should be for all Vaishnavas, what a family is basically a very long-term bhakta program, which you get to start A lot of times our Bhakti programs are difficult because we bring in people who have various backgrounds, but if you start before conception, you can do a really good job of getting a very, very good crew. Therefore, especially for Brahmins, we're very, very intelligent for learning and teaching the Vedas. So their reason is less economic than it is it is to raise a Krishna conscious child, right? But that's for the benefit of other people more than yourself. Okay? Yeah, it does have a lot of different meanings. Uh-huh. I may have a Sanskrit dictionary here on my computer. I can type it in. Vritti. Mode of life or conduct, course of action, behavior, especially moral conduct, general usage, common practice, rule, mode of being, nature, kind, character, disposition, occupation, business, engaged in this or that, the other thing, what you live by. Mood of the mind. Mode or measure of pronunciation. Then it gets specialized meanings in grammar. But that's the main meaning. Huh? Yeah, it's Mona Williams. Gopi Puranadana scanned every page. Now it's available on computers. Yes? Oh, it's gotten late. Maybe we better wind up, huh? So I just want you to understand from this what Prabhupada's entire... I said you have to understand the whole context and what the purpose is and what Prabhupada wants to restore and to see things in that way and why it's important that we understand this idea of nature, what a woman is, what a man is, why Prabhupada is against feminism, and so on. It doesn't mean that you can take, as we see, that you can take people who have been raised and trained in a modern industrial society and suddenly cram them into some mold that they don't fit. I mean, that was the other thing. Prabhupada just engaged people according to whatever way they were. That we should continue to do. But at least you see which direction we're supposed to go in. And in any case, all of these ideas of hierarchy, first class man, second class man, you know, and so forth, that this is all in a system where that's supposed to be highly under the influence of Brahmins, and so that the dominating understanding will always be to see the equality of everybody as spirit souls and as Vaishnavas, and therefore to be treated with the utmost respect. If that's there, if this strong idea of spiritual equality is there and actually acted on, it's not just a theory, but actually acted on, and then people are engaged according to their different material natures, then I think it will work out. And as long as everybody who's, those people who have power over other people, anyone who has power over somebody else, naturally occurring power, is actually also a natural representative of God. If they actually represent God, then everything will work out fine. If they don't represent